Encourage all you people of the land, says the Lord. Work, for I am with you, says the Lord of hosts, according to the promise that I made when you came out of Egypt. My spirit abides among you. Do not fear. Do not fear. These are the words God is forever saying to God's people. But we are afraid. This is the Sunday before the election, and for mostly opposite reasons, each of us is afraid for the future of our country. Afraid for our children and our children's children. Afraid for our financial well-being. Afraid for the nation's status in the world. Afraid, in some, for life as we think it will become if our candidate should not prevail. This is also the Sunday, as you know now, before the Sunday when we bring our pledges forward. And for mostly unfaithful reasons, I am afraid. I am afraid you will not pledge because the ministers let you down. Afraid all the appeals have left you still thinking a modest contribution will do. Afraid you think there are rich people in the pews, so you do not need to give very much. Afraid our pledges will fall short, and I will be anxious every day of next year, like I was this year, and faithfully fearful. When fears such as these prevail, according to psychologist Stephen Spozny, people tend to revert to what he calls toddler brain, an emotional all-or-nothing thinking, as shadow of this coming Tuesday and Sunday next, I opened the Bible with trepidation to Haggai. Of all the obscure little books we could have been given by the lectionary this morning, Haggai is one of the littlest and most obscure. Yet the words and the strategies of the prophet, credited with rebuilding the second temple almost single-handedly, could not be more relevant to the situation we find ourselves in right now. Prophesying between August and December 520 BCE. I love it when the Bible is that exact. Between August and December in 520 BCE, 2 decades after the people of Judah had returned from exile in Babylon. He tells them to get over their fears and get on with the life of faithful service to God. Easier said than done, I think. Haggai was sent to a people hell-bent on getting their old lives back. Lavishly restoring the houses they once lived in, circling the wagons around kith and kin, socking away what little money they made to secure their individual futures. All were ways of coping with what we might call the post-traumatic stress of being exiled from life as they know it. A metaphor, perhaps. Well, all this they did for themselves, while willfully ignoring the fact that the temple, the dwelling place of God, the foundation and center of their common life, was in ruins. Another metaphor. The prophet's assessment of the situation sent him to his knees. To put Marilyn Robinson's words in the prophet's mouth, Haggai knew that those who forget God, the single assurance of our safety, however that word may be defined, and the single assurance of our future, I might add, those who forget God can be recognized in the fact that they make irrational responses to irrational fears. Well, instead of playing to their fears, Haggai names the fearful emptiness of their grasping lives. He writes, "You have sown much and harvested little. You eat, but you never have enough. You drink, but you never have your fill. You clothe yourselves, but no one is warm. And you that earn wages to put them in bags with holes. My house is in ruins while you hurry off to your own," says the Lord. Well, for Haggai, shaming worked. So far, it hasn't worked for me. The people listened, and in 5 short years, the temple was completed. But soon, and this is where we come with our reading today, soon the word on the street was a word of despair. The new house was not like the old house. So, Haggai called together the leaders and the people and asked, "Who among them had seen the temple in its former glory?" Only a few old hands went up in the crowd. It had been 65 years since it had been destroyed. "It would be as if I were to ask you, who among us remembers the former glory of this church in the 1950s? Let me see hands of those of you who were here in the 1950s. Okay, some hands going up there. you were black or gay or a woman with ambitions and dreams of her own. The 1950s were no Camelot. Social location has everything to do with how past glory is remembered. Yet Haggai is focusing on those who remembered well. For he says next to those people who raise their hands, how does it look to you now? And he anticipates their answer saying, is it not in your sight as nothing? Here is the moment where I think he intuits the fear just beneath the surface of the older generation's disappointment and despair. According to Ezra, because the second temple appeared to be just a shell of the first, the old-timers wept at its dedication when they remembered their past. Even as the millennials shouted for joy, seeing the second temple as the potential for a new future. It is the weepers, a seminary classmate of mine writes, who are Haggai's main audience when he says with sympathy, is it not in your sight as nothing? Himself an old-timer like me, my classmate imagines them thinking, if we just sacrificed in the old way, did ritual in the old way, dressed in the old way, then somehow all those people who had moved on and changed and become indifferent today would just come back and act what they did back when we were young. Haggai could have thrown in with the weepers and been hailed as the champion of their despair. Instead, he simply acknowledged their despair was real. But then in the next breath, he told them to get to work because God was with them. Did you forget that? That is to say, the prophet's antidote for fear was to evoke trust in the God who was present in their human history and in whose love all history will finally be resolved. What matters now, says Haggai, is not the temple in its former glory, but their faithfulness to the God who first promised to be their God when? Not when the temple was filled with all gold and silver and glory, but God first promised to be their God back when they had nothing. Nothing but their freedom and the clothes on their backs and manna sufficient for the day from God's hand. That God had work for them to do. In other words, Haggai was evoking not the 50s, of the 30s. Take courage, he says, to the governor, to the priest, to the people. God's Spirit abides among you, all of you. God's Spirit abides in the spaces between you, no matter how wide they have become. Work, says the Lord of hosts, for I am with you. Fear not. One thing is certain. Come Tuesday, either the person you greatly fear will bring us all to ruin, or the person you vaguely hope will keep us from the abyss will be elected. And another thing is certain. Come next Sunday, the work we have to do as Christ Church in a divided, distrustful, and fearful nation will be all the more critical. It is the work and the witness of a people who trust that in life and in death, 3 more columns in exchange for cleaning my oven. I always had a dream that when I'm asked to give an accounting of my life to a higher court, it will be like this. So, empty your pockets. What you got left of your life? Any dreams that were unfilled? Any unused talents that we gave you when you were born that you still have left? Any unsaid compliments or bits of love that you haven't spread around? And I will answer, I've nothing to return. I spent everything you gave me. I'm as naked as the day I was born. That, it seems to me, is living in the trust that conquers fear. Therefore, I implore you to give it a try. Empty your pockets for the sake of the church's witness to God's love, trusting in the God who first promised to be our God when we had nothing, the God in whose hand